Blog Talk Radio.
Are you ready to take a bite out of the competition? Are you looking for ideas to make your business better? Welcome to the Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet,
sponsored by Apple Capital Group.
At the core of every successful business, you'll find people making a difference. And with each episode of the Core Business Show, we talk with those people, examine those ideas, and explore the strategies that make them special. Now, the host of the Core Business Show, Tim Jacquet.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Core Business Show. I'm Tim Jacquet, your host. Today, we're going to talk about, for the next 2 weeks, our release this week, about selling to the government. We're going to promote several series throughout this week. We'll have to end up going through next week in order to get the whole series in. It's a lot of detailed information that if you're a business and you're looking for another avenue to sell things to businesses, to the government, here's another customer, a very good customer that pays well. So anyway, we're going to take a break real quick, and we'll come back with the show. You're listening to The Core Business Show. I'm Tim Jacquet, your host.
You're listening to The Core Business Show, sponsored by Apple Capital Group. Apple Capital Group in Jacksonville, Florida, is a commercial lender that specializes in asset-based loans, equipment leasing and financing, invoice financing, commercial real estate loans, and asset-based financing in the U.S. and Canada. Apple Capital Group is a direct lender that lends on their private equity investment portfolio. 90% of most loans are decided within 2 hours, and vendor funding within 24 hours after documents are completed with a one-page application. No slow no's, just a quick decision and a fast yes. To get more information about lending from Apple Capital Group, call 866-611-7457. That's 866-611-7457 to speak with one of our loan specialists. Or visit us right now at applecapitalgroup.com. Welcome back to The Core. Once again, here's Tim Jacquet.
Welcome back to the Core Business Show. So what I'm going to do is going to start. We're going to roll our first interview. We're going to talk to a person. We actually recorded this some time ago. And I said, oh, this is probably good information that I can use for a show. So this is going to tell you the whole scope that you really need to know about selling to the government. Selling to a local government, which is a city, municipality, or a port, or a transit authority, how to sell to the state, and also how to sell to the federal government. There are different systems that's always in place for each, and you have to know the lingo. You have to know the procedure, how they actually buy things from the public. So go ahead and listen to the show. We're going to take a commercial break in between these episodes. Today's is going to be split up into probably around six different 10-minute breaks, 10-minute episodes that I did the interviews on. So we're going to go ahead and proceed with the first section of selling to the government. Defining your scope is defining what your business is and defining what you're actually trying to solicit to the government.
Welcome to the boot camp, and we term it a boot camp because it is rather intensive. I went through boot camp myself. Obviously, this is not going to be as intensive as that was, but it will be intensive. We're going to be asking a lot of you. We're going to be asking you to put a lot of thought into what we're presenting. So, on day one, we're going to help you assess the opportunities. Day two, we're going to show you how to do some of the marketing. And then day three, we're going to take you through some actual bid situations. First of all, you have to define the scope of what it is that you're attempting to sell to the government, or find out what the government needs. And part of what we're going to show you in that is that the government buys everything. The government buys everything that any other company, any other customer buys. It isn't only aircraft and aircraft carriers and tanks and so on. They buy cleaning supplies. They buy services to improve their business operations. They buy landscaping services. Everything that is sold in the marketplace, the government buys. So don't think that because it's the government, the federal government in particular, that you're not going to be able to address them, because you will be able to. We'll show you how to lay the groundwork to get to a decision maker within the government. Obviously, when you walk in the front door of an agency, the first person you meet is not going to be the person that's going to decide that they want to use your products or services. You have to know who in that agency to call on. You have to know who the decision makers are. We're going to show you how to find out who that is. And then the Federal Acquisition Regulation. You know, it's a it's a book like this. And when I went to work for the Navy as a civilian, one of the first things they did was send me to a two-week course, 8 to 5, with homework for 2 weeks. And we went through the regulation page by page. So that by the time I came out of that, I understood what was in that regulation. It wasn't called FAR then. It was called ASPR, Armed Services Procurement Regulation. But we'll have some more on that also later in the sessions. And then we're going to show you how to do a SWOT analysis, strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and so on. And then we're going to show you how to analyze your organization to see what your organization is capable of and what kind of changes you might make to your organization to make it more viable in the government marketplace. There's certain things that you have to do in the government marketplace that are perhaps more restrictive than you would find in the commercial marketplace, and we'll show you how to work through those. We're also going to show you the GSA schedules, General Services Administration schedules. Now, why the government has chosen to put the term schedule there is beyond me, because it's just contract, General Services Administration contract. So every time you see that schedule, you just read that as contract. And we're going to show you how to use that schedule, that contract, once you have it. You know, when you walk in to a commercial customer and you sell the customer, and the customer says, "Yeah, I want to deal with you." He'll write you a contract, right? He'll write on the spot. You'll be dealing with, generally, in many cases, somebody, a decision maker in that organization. He'll write you a contract. Well, in the government, it's not going to work that way. So if they say, "How do I get to you?" you hold up your GSA schedule and say, "Here's the contract." All you have to do is issue a delivery order against them. We're going to show you how that works and how to go about getting one. We're also going to show you how to go about finding the business. You have to find the people in each organization that can make the decision to come to you to buy what it is you're offering, what is the service or products. We're going to show you how to rework or create your marketing materials so that they're more effective. We're going to take you through the pre-bid process. Then in day 3, we're going to actually run through an IFB. Now, we're going to show you the difference between the IFB process and the RFP process. And just to start off, the government regulations say that every procurement has to be competitive, except for, and then they list the exceptions. Obviously, there are exceptions, public exigency, and when the bombs are falling, you may not have a chance to go out in a competitive situation. So there's a listing of exceptions. Well, within that competitive spectrum, one of those is an invitation for bid, and we're going to show you how to go through and read and respond to an invitation for bid. We're also going to show you then how to respond to an RFP. An RFP can be sole source, or it can also be competitive. But it's not competitive in the same way that an IFB is. And we'll show you the difference as we go through that process. We're going to show you also how solicitations get issued, because that's one of the things you're going to want to know when you go into a customer. You know, you convince somebody that they want to deal with you. Well, then what's the process that the government has to go through to get to you? if you don't have a schedule, for instance, if you have to go through a solicitation process. So you want to know how they get issued, and also you want to know how those bids get evaluated. In an RFP situation, it isn't only the low bidder that's going to win. It's going to be best value to the government. And so you need to know what those criteria are that are going to be evaluated in that solicitation. And we're going to show you how to zero in on what those are and how to respond to them. There's also, there's always financial considerations to performing a government contract. And we're going to have some words for you on how to do the financing, what kind of government financing might be available to you, and what kind of financing is available in the commercial marketplace. And that's going to affect the funding your future, and then we're going to show you how what to do to take the next steps. Once you leave this session, this three-day session, what you should be doing when you leave here to start to get that first contract. So first we're going to define the scope. Understand what the government buys. I said the government buys everything. So whatever you sell, the government is going to buy. Now, it's going to be very easy to decide if you determine what the government wants to buy in a certain situation, and it happens to be what you sell. I mean, that's a nice mix. The chances are that's not going to happen all the time. So you may have to look at what it is that you sell that maybe you can tweak, that you can do something a little different in order to make it acceptable to the government. So we're going to show you how to do some of that. And then we're going to have a fair amount on the different type of solicitations. You know, I already mentioned IFB and RFP and so on. We're going to give you a fair amount of detail on how to respond to those and what those are. You know, there's a bit of a mystique in dealing with the government. And it really isn't all that different from dealing with the commercial customers. There's always going to be a different time period in getting to contract when you're dealing with the government. But the process that you go through, the marketing process that you go through, the way you sell yourself is not terribly different from the commercial marketplace. And we're going to show you how to market to not only the government, but to prime contractors. And we already have some experience here with some of the folks here who've dealt with prime contractors and also with other subcontractors. You don't necessarily have to be a first-tier sub in order to get a contract that's part of the government marketplace. You can be a second tier, third tier, wherever you happen to end up. Also, the government fiscal year ends on September 30. And while that's certainly a point of interest and information, it also will show you how that can be important to you. You've all heard that the government, if they haven't spent their money by the end of the fiscal year, they lose it. Well, they get anxious as they get close to the end of the fiscal year. And if you've done your marketing, we'll show you how that feeds in the future. Also, the government has worldwide opportunities. I mean, obviously, right now we have a couple of wars going on, and you know, if you have a service or product that could be used in Afghanistan or Iraq, then you ought to be selling that at this point. Also, for instance, the State Department has embassies around the world, and they use a lot of products in those embassies. And again, you can certainly benefit from addressing the State Department as a potential customer.
We're going to take a station break real quick, and we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to The Core Business Show.
You're listening to The Core Business Show, sponsored by Apple Capital Group. Apple Capital Group in Jacksonville, Florida, is a commercial lender that specializes in asset-based loans, equipment leasing and financing, invoice financing, commercial real estate loans, and asset-based financing in the U.S. and Canada. Apple Capital Group is a direct lender that lends on their private equity investment portfolio. 90% of most loans are decided within 2 hours, and vendor funding within 24 hours after documents are completed with a one-page application. No slow no's, just a quick decision and a fast yes. To get more information about lending from Apple Capital Group, call 866-611-7457. That's 866-611-7457 to speak with one of our loan specialists. Or visit us right now at applecapitalgroup.com. Welcome back to The Core. Once again, here's Tim Jacquin.
I mentioned that the timeline, the lead times for dealing with the government are often much, much longer than you would find in the commercial marketplace. And that's something that you have to be aware of as you start the marketing process. You have to be ready and able to wait that period and to continue the marketing effort during that period until you get to a contract and not get frustrated and so on as you go down the line. As is probably apparent, the federal government is the largest customer in the country and probably in the world, but it certainly is the largest customer in the United States. More than $327 billion will be spent on government contracts this year. $327 billion. And a portion of that is specifically set aside, is earmarked to be set aside for small businesses. And we'll go into a lot more detail on how those set-asides work and who are small businesses and so on later in the session. And so this is kind of a gee whiz chart. Break that $327 billion down. Comes down to $10,397 spent by the federal government every second. $10,000. Now that's obviously not every, that doesn't mean a contract for $10,000, but it means $10,000 spent on contracts. Obviously some of them are with large businesses, they're building aircraft carriers and that sort of thing. But a tremendous amount of that is available to be set aside for small business. And I'm assuming we're all small businesses here. The Federal Acquisition Regulation, as I mentioned, the fairly large document, it says that for solicitations under $100,000, they are supposed to be considered to be set aside for small businesses. So the large business can't even respond. I will show you some more detail on that as to how the government goes through the research to determine that there are small businesses out there that can respond. I mean, obviously, if there's nobody out there that can respond for what they're trying to do in the small business world, they're going to go to somebody that can. And in many cases, that'll be a large business. But if the research shows that it can be set aside for small business, then they have to do that. And I guess one of the points we're going to be making as we go through, the government's market research isn't always infallible. However, if you've been doing your marketing, then they know there's somebody out there that can do those things. Then it isn't dependent on having done the marketing research. They know your company can do this. And, you know, there's an old marketing adage that people buy from people they know. And I don't want to let you think that because you're going to get a GSA schedule following this 3-day session, that business is going to roll in, because it isn't. You have to market yourself. You have to market that contract. You have to use that contract, any contract that you have, as an entree to convince that customer that they have a means. Number one, they want to come to you because they like what it is you do, and they have a means of getting to you. Who are the policemen in these roles? What is? There's several. Every agency at fairly low levels has small business specialists. And the whole process starts with the government writing what's called a procurement request, purchase request. It's a PR. When that PR goes from the originator, which normally is a technical type operation, it goes through a financial office, so it gets funded. It then, before it goes to the contracting officer, it goes through the small business specialist. And the small business specialist has to sign off on that. So one of the people you're going to want to make sure that you make contact with in every agency that you want to go with is that small business specialist. So the small business specialist knows who you are. And when that PR comes across his desk, he's going to say, yeah, there's at least one guy out there because he's been calling on me. As we mentioned, the government has very aggressive small business goals, small business set-aside goals. And their overall goal is that they'd like to see 39% of the overall procurement dollars spent with small businesses. That breaks down into a number of categories. Overall, small business is 20%. They like to have it. Now, we get down to small disadvantaged business and 8A firms. They like to have 6%. Do you have any women-owned firms here? Okay. They'd like to see 5% of that $327 billion go to you. You get down here to the hub zone and the service-disabled veteran-owned. Greg is a service-disabled veteran. This is mandated. 3% of those dollars have to go to service-disabled veterans. Veteran-owned companies. Now, hub zone is a category that isn't mandated, but is a very significant one because the hub zones are historically underutilized business zones. And the government would like to get business into those zones. And so in many cases, they'll go sole source if you happen to have your business set up in one of those zones. Now, you have to actually have your business established in there. We're going to show you some more detail on that later on. And then just plain 2% to overall veteran-owned. So this gives you a good picture of what these small business set-aside goals are. And we're going to show you later on that in addition to the government having these goals, every prime contractor has to write and have approved a small business subcontracting plan as part of getting their prime contract. And again, the same thing. If that prime contractor knows you, then they're going to have you in that plan. And they get graded on how well they do against that plan. The contracting officers get graded on how well they do, how close they come to this 39%. And we're going to show you, too, that in many cases, some of you are going to have more than one of these categories. You're going to be woman-owned. You're obviously going to be a small business. You may be an 8A firm or a small disadvantaged business, and so on. You're going to have a disabled veteran here. You can qualify in a couple of those. Now, I don't mean to tell you that increases your percentage, but it does make you more attractive to a contracting officer because contracting officers get marked on how close they come to these percentages. Well, if they can put you down in two of those categories, you know, they get a better mark. And the agencies actually grade their contracting officers on how well they do on this. And the subcontract specialist in that agency is right in the middle of all of that. If the subcontracting specialist feels that the small businesses are being ignored, he runs the flag up. So again, prime contractors are tasked with meeting these as well as the government. Now, just as another gee whiz number, 39% of $327 billion comes out to $127.5 billion. That's a lot of money that you're addressing, a lot of potential. I mean, think what it would be if your company is doing $100,000 a month or $100,000 a half a year and you were to get a $2 million contract. I mean, it's the impact on your business is going to be dramatic once you get one of these contracts. again, we just made the point. They buy everything from pencils to airplanes. Probably nobody in this group is going to be in the process of selling them airplanes, but you certainly could be in the business of selling them pencils. We're going to show you what the supply codes and the product service codes are for each of the products that the government buys. Those are going to be significant for you because it's going to tell you exactly where you need to be putting your focus. Who are the customers? The federal customer consists of 1,174 different agencies. And they're all over the country. And as I said, many of them are all over the world. Plus, you've got to come down to the state agencies. And then some of these contracts that we're going to be talking about can be used down at the school board level. That's how far down this chain you can go in dealing with the government. And again, we already mentioned that the large prime contractors have to meet these subcontracting goals.
You're listening to the Core Business Show, sponsored by Apple Capital Group.
And I spent, they mentioned, 30 years at IBM. And one of my jobs was, when I was a procurement manager, was to go out and meet with small business symposia and present what it was that we in IBM in that particular division, the Federal Systems Division, were buying, what we were interested in procuring. And I told the attendees, the small businesses, I said, that's not because we're altruistic. It's because, number one, it's easier to deal with a small business than it is with a large business. I mean, if somebody came to IBM and they wanted to do something special, you know, we had to go to Armonk, New York to get approval to do something special. When you're dealing with small business, you're dealing with the owner of the business. You want something special, the owner says yes or no. I mean, you know immediately whether or not you're going to be able to do it. Also, small businesses are traditionally cheaper than large businesses. I had a case down in Houston when I was down there. I was a member of National Contract Management Association, and we had a session one time on using small businesses and dealing with NASA. And one of the companies, Philco Ford, said, well, you know, I had this requirement, and I put it out to Joe Blow over here, and he came in, and he was 30% more expensive than what we could do it for in-house. And so I said to him, how long were your folks working on that in-house? He said, well, we've been working on that for about 18 months. I said, how long did you give the small business guy to bid that? He said, 2 weeks. I said, you can't expect any business, large or small, to be able to respond in 2 weeks to something you've been working on for 18 months. So I use that as an example to say, number one, get in early on these projects. Do your marketing so that you have more than 2 weeks to respond. So you don't get sucked into something like that, and the guy justifies, well, I couldn't award to him because it's more expensive. Almost 95% of the time, the small business is going to be cheaper than the large business, and that's going to be to your advantage when you go to these contracting officers. How do they buy? The micro purchases are under $2,500. For those, you're going to have the ability to accept credit cards, and we're going to show you a little more detail on that. Simplified acquisitions go up to $100,000. Sole source awards, there are sole source awards. They're generally in emergency situations. There certainly could be situations where you truly would be a single source or a sole source, but it's not going to be very often. But there are going to be situations where there's an emergency somewhere in the country, somewhere in the world, where they're going to have to board a contract immediately. Sealed bidding is the IFB route, which we're going to walk you through that, and negotiated procurement is the RFP route. The difference between the two is that in the negotiated procurement, what they're buying is not cut and dried, and there's going to have to be some discussions between the government and the bidders, and so they go through a negotiated procurement route so they can conduct those discussions and get to a best value, get to an understanding where they can get to a best value. Then you're going to hear all kinds of acronyms, IDIQ, indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity. When you get a contract like that, you don't have guarantee of anything. What you have is a contract that allows the government to buy if and when they get to the point where they want to buy. But they don't guarantee you any business under those contracts. Government-wide acquisitions and multiple awards. The federal supply schedules are multiple award contracts. When you get a GSA schedule for whatever it is you're going to offer, there's going to be at least one other company that has that same schedule. And you're going to come up against them in competition when you're attempting to get business. The government-wide acquisition contracts are generally awarded for items that GSA wouldn't be awarding. The GSA tends to be more the housekeeping, the across-the-board, ordinary, standard commercial items. The government-wide acquisition contracts would be awarded by somebody like somebody in the Department of Defense. There might be a particular type of a weapon system or something like that where other agencies could buy off of that GWAC contract. For instance, the Air Force and the Navy might be buying the same aircraft. And one of them would be the lead agency for that aircraft, and the other agency would buy off that same contract. Now, there's generally a fee associated where the holder of the GWAC contract gets paid a fee by the other government agency that wants to use it. Chances, again, of you getting involved in a GWAC are probably nil. But you have to know they're out there. And it doesn't hurt you to know who has them, because you certainly could be a subcontractor to somebody that has a government-wide contract. And then we'll talk you a fair amount of the of detail on the GSA schedules. Micro purchases, no competition required. You sell them that you've got something they want to buy for $2,500 or less, they can just give you an order. Can use a government credit card. You get paid immediately. There's no problem with invoicing or whatever. You know, you're paid on the spot. Simplified, up to $100,000. Now, in that case, they're going to get quotes from at least three people in most cases. They prefer to place those with small businesses, and in those cases, they're going to be either fixed price or time and materials. Now, time and material, we're going to show you a little more detail later on as to how these various types of contracts work and what you have to be aware of if you have one of those types. You have to be able to document the hours expended, you know, in a very precise manner. You have to have a good cost accounting system. And that's not a problem because there's a lot of those systems that are out there to be purchased, you know, off the shelf. Again, the question of sole source. I always like to say that the one that's not up there is having a friend in the White House, but, you know, that's a... But there are a lot of situations where the government has maintained the shipbuilding capability in this country. It's because when the flag goes up, you know, and we need ships, we need a capability of building them. So they have kept various shipbuilding yards mobilized. There's some that are required by statute. For instance, a lot of very precise products need jeweled bearings. Well, up in, I think it's in North Dakota, there's a small plant that produces those jeweled bearings. And so anytime you have a contract, anytime anybody has a contract that is going to require the use of jeweled bearings, they're going to have to go to that one location to get them. So there's good reasons for sole source awards. But you're probably not going to be in too many situations early on where you're going to be getting a sole source award. I don't want to mislead you on that. You're probably going to usually be involved in some sort of competition. They also use a procedure called an RFQ, request for quote, and you'll see those. Those are used when the government really doesn't have a good feel yet for what kind of response they're going to get. And so they'll put out a request for quote. Now, request for quote, by its own terms, by the language of the package itself, can't result in a contract. Where an IFB, when you submit your IFB bid, if you are the low bidder and you're responsive and responsible, and we'll show you a little more about what that means, then the contracting officer can sign that on the spot. And you don't have a choice of saying, well, gee, I don't think I want to take it now. You submitted a bid, and the contracting officer signs it. You've got a contract. Now, with an RFQ, the contracting officer can't do that because it cannot go directly from an RFQ to a contract. What the contracting officer has to do in that case is look at all the responses that came in and make a choice as to who he'd like to deal with and then offer that person a contract. Now, if between the time you submitted your response to the RFQ and when the contracting officer calls you and says, hey, I'm sending you a contract, if you found out that you made a mistake in the in your calculations, you found out that your major supplier just went out of business, you found out that something happened that says you can't perform that contract the way you offered it, you can at that point say, I'm sorry, I can't I can't take it on that basis. And the contracting officer maybe go to somebody else, or the contracting officer may say, hey, you were good enough in the response. I liked your response. Let's negotiate. And can come up with an acceptable solution. The IFB, as I said, is used to buy things that are known. Known quantities and known qualities, whatever. And it's always going to end up in a firm fixed price contract. And when the bid's open, the lowest price is going to, provided the bidder is responsive and responsible, the lowest price is going to win. And if, I used to go to a lot of those bid openings when I was working for the Navy, and they're somewhat humorous because many of the bidders are convinced that the bids are going to be leaked before they're open. You submit your bid, and you bid $10, and somebody's going to see that and call their buddy and say, come in at 9. So we would see people outside the bid room. Back in those days, it was on payphones, calling to get the number to write into the bid package 2 minutes before the bids were due. And these IFBs, if the bid isn't in the bid box at the stated time on the stated date, you're not considered. It's not a bid. So they'd wait until a couple of minutes before, write in the numbers. They wouldn't have known the numbers that were going to be in that bid package until they made that phone call. They write in the numbers, walk into the bid room, drop it in the bid box, and then stand there and watch. Make sure nobody came to those. And then, 5 minutes later, 2 minutes later, the bid box would be open. All the bids would be read. Everybody, it's public opening, so everybody knows exactly what everybody else bid. And we'll talk some more about how you get to be considered a small business and that sort of thing. And some of them are self-certifying. If you say you're a woman-owned business, you better have a woman running the business. That's fairly easy to substantiate if somebody challenges you. But if one of the other bidders who came in second suspects that you're not really a small business, then they'll challenge that. In fact, it was just a case probably 2 months ago now where a guy had been presenting himself as a small business for a couple of years and had gotten a fair number of contracts based on that. Somebody finally challenged him, and he was fined $500,000 for misrepresenting himself over a number of years. Because he wasn't really. He had structured a corporate structure so that he was down here when he was really the whole package. But somebody challenged him. One of the other bidders challenged him, and they were successful. So at bid opening, lowest price wins, but we're going to show you what you have to do in order to be that lowest price and be responsive and responsible. And here we come to the RFP. And in these cases, the requirements are generally complex. They're not straightforward, easy to describe, easy to quantify, and so on. They're going to be situations where there have to be some evaluation factors other than price, where there's going to have to be discussions between the government and the bidder. And the best value is going to be a cost-technical trade-off. Within government procurement, trends come and go. I mean, there's always the latest thing. Well, this is going to solve all our problems. Well, years ago, they came up with incentive contracts. And we're going to really make this a strong incentive contract, and that's going to dictate how you perform on this. Well, a couple of those put the incentives only on the technical capability of what they were buying without regard to cost. And so suddenly things that had been fairly well defined with regard to cost, the cost went up 30, 40, 50% because the contractors were trying to reach these incentives on the performance because a lot of their fee was associated with reaching those incentives. Well, then the regulations were changed to say that any time you have a performance incentive, you also must have a cost incentive. There has to be this cost technical trade-off within those contracts. And again, any pricing structure can be used when you talk about requests for proposal. They don't have to be firm fixed price. They can be cost plus fixed fee, cost plus award fee, cost plus incentive fee. It can be cost sharing where the contractor puts up some of the cost and the government puts up the rest. They can be any structure as opposed to firm fixed price. IDIQ contracts. One of the benefits of having an IDIQ contract from the government standpoint is that the companies, the bidders, the offerers, the contractors, have all been pre-qualified. They don't have to go through the process of determining whether or not you're responsible, whether or not you have the financial capability to do what it is that the contract calls for. You've been pre-qualified. So the contracting officers love that, being able to get to somebody on an IDIQ contract. They may be single or multiple awards. In your cases, I wouldn't consider that you're ever going to have a single award for something like that. There are always going to be multiple awards. They may be competed or sole source. Depending on where you are in the amount of the contract, you could end up with sole source because you're a hub zone contractor. So keep that in mind that if you, for instance, if you happen to have your business in an area that's not a hub zone, but there's a hub zone area a half a mile away, you might consider moving your business. I mean, you could have your office or your warehouse, whatever it is your business consists of, in a hub zone as well as where you have it now. And you get all the increasing capability if you do that. Now, as I mentioned earlier, when someone uses a government-wide GWAC, then the agency that uses it has to pay a fee to the agency that owns the contract. And you'll find sometimes that contracting officers won't want to do that, won't want to use that GWAC contract because they don't want to pay the fee. And so if you at that point have a GSA schedule that happens to cover something similar to that, you may be able to work them over to use a GSA schedule. GWACs are usually multiple award as well as multiple awards are averagely. And the multiple award contracts are almost always IDIQ. I could conceive of a situation where you might not have an IDIQ, but almost always they're going to be. Again, the similarities are related to the prices in terms of, and the government likes to use that type because of the fact that the prices and terms are already negotiated. They're already set. They don't have to go through that process each time. One of the reasons that the government started using these types of contracts, IDIQs and GSA schedules and so on, came home to me in the computer industry at IBM. If we had a solicitation come out, an RFP, that we had to respond to, normally there would be a several-month period that the government would go through to prepare that solicitation. They have to check with everybody in the agency as to what they wanted and what kind of characteristics these things had to have and so on. So they'd prepare a solicitation. That solicitation would then be issued, and people like IBM would have to respond to that, and we would normally have 90 days to respond. And we would marshal a large group of people to make sure that we understood what the criteria were that we're going to use in the evaluation, and we'd have to write to all of those, and then we'd submit the bid. So already you're into probably 5 months into this process. 2 months to prepare the solicitation, 3 months to bid. Then they go through an evaluation process of anywhere from 3 to 4 or 5 months. And they would come down to and they might have discussions with the bidders because that's part of the reason for doing that. and they'd come down to a situation where they would make a selection. And that selection process was always very elaborate, you know, with boards established. And people from outside the agency would come in and be on the board so they wouldn't be tainted by prejudices and so on. And they'd make a selection, and then they would announce the award. Well, everybody that wasn't selected would then protest. Because obviously, if they didn't select me, they'd think this process was faulty. So then we'd start through the protest process. Well, the protest would add on anywhere from 3 to 6 months. And then another award would be made, another selection. And maybe people would have to rebid. And they used to have best and final offers. And then they would call them, those would be BAFOs, best and final offers. Then they would have BARFOs, best and really final offers. I mean, sometimes you'd go through 3 or 4 or 5 of those.
You're listening to The Core Business Show, sponsored by Apple Capital Group.
Well, you know, by the time this thing got awarded, you might have 20 months from the time the requirement originated until they finally got a contract. Well, in the computer world, those computers that you bid 20 months ago and that you rebid maybe 6 months ago, 5 months, they don't exist anymore. They're gone. So you won the thing on competitive prices for stuff that doesn't exist anymore, right? Well, what do? Well, you have to substitute stuff in. You have to substitute today's products in. Well, at that point, you're sole source. I mean, they're not going to go and get more bids again. You're going to substitute stuff in at today's prices. Well, you'll give them a discount, but they'll be at today's price. So they, anyway, the government looked at this and said, wait a minute, this is crazy. We're going through a 20-month process and ending up with a sole source. That doesn't make any sense. So then they say, oh, let's go with this IDIQ arrangement where we have multiple awards. And each awardee then is asked to bid each time that a requirement comes up. And, you know, you have an item on there for $10. And the government comes to you and says, gee, I'd like to buy from you because you've been doing the marketing and everything, and I know you. But, you know, John Smith got a schedule, and he's selling the same capability, the same product for $9.50. Do you think you'd like to match that price, and then I'll buy for you? Well, surely you would. Yeah, I'll match that price. And that was a big. We're going to show you some of the sequence that we went through to get to this type of a situation in the government contracting. It used to be when you had one of these GSA schedules, if you dropped the price was dropped to everybody. In fact, it went back to the first of the year. Anybody that you'd already sold, you had to give them a refund. Well, they changed the rule. They changed the regulation to say that when you drop the price to a government agency, then that doesn't affect anybody else. That just means that agency got a better deal. You entered into a competitive situation, and you met the competition in that situation. One time when I was a young contract negotiator with the Navy, I went out to buy a printing press. This is before the days of all the printers we have now and the computers and stuff. And we needed a printing press for use on an aircraft carrier. So we went to one of the big printing press companies to get a big, 1,000 page per minute or whatever printer. And it was on a GSA schedule. And we thought that the price that was on there had some fluff in it. I won't go into the details of why we thought that, but we thought there was some fluff in that. And so I called the president of the company. He was, a Fortune 500 company. And told him that, we really didn't think we wanted to spend $100,000 for this printing press. We thought maybe we ought to spend about $85,000. That was more in line with what we had in mind. He said, well, I guess I can do that. So we wrote the order for $85,000 and sent it off. Well, you know, that wasn't fair to him because he didn't know the terms of that contract that said now every printer for that year was $85,000. And anyone he'd already sold, he had to give $15,000 back. I never did that again. I was young at the time, and I didn't really realize what I was doing to him. That I was. Now, the difference for a a multiple award contract that is not a GSA schedule is that the buying activity has to go through a what's called a DNF, determination and finding. They have to justify why they want to use that contract. And part of the justification would be agreeing why that the fee that's associated with that is something that, that they'd like to pay because it's going to save them all the cost of going through a solicitation. But they do have to go through that DNF. And then he'd have to establish a memorandum of understanding with the agency that owned the contract. Now, that's not an impossible situation, but it is something you have to go through, and that would take a little time if you were in that situation. You'd have to anticipate that you'd have to wait while that happens. They also, there's another technique that the government uses, a request for information, and that is purely that. They really don't know who's out there. They don't know what capabilities are in a particular area. That would be in a research and development type of arena where they would want somebody to come in and tell them what they could do in a particular area. There wouldn't be normally any pricing associated with that. It would be a capability type of presentation. RFQ is a request for quote, and that's normally used when the item is fairly well defined, but they don't really know who's out there and what kind of prices they're going to get. No, see, the government is required to go through a process of determining what they expect a particular procurement to cost because they have to go into the budget process and get the funds set aside. So when it comes time to sign the contract, the funds are there to go on the contract because the government cannot sign a contract for funds that it doesn't have. You know, contracting officers can get locked up for that. That's a definite no-no. If we talked about IFB, RFP, sources sought is kind of another way of saying the request for information. And sometimes they'll put out a combined synopsis and solicitation. They're in a hurry to get responses, so they're going to put out a synopsis of what they want. And they're going to, in that same package, they're going to say, hey, give us a response, give us a bid. On the RFQ, they're looking for specific dollar bids on advertised items. Again, they can't go to a contract from an RFQ, but they can certainly issue a contract following an receipt of an RFQ. Now, you look at RFPs, and there's going to be all kinds of technical information in that package. There's going to be charts and pictures and specifications and so on that you're going to have to respond to. And we're going to have a little more detail on that. One small incident along those lines, when I worked for IBM, we had developed what we called a mail sack label reader. All the mail eventually gets put in sacks, you know, and then those sacks get put on a truck and they get delivered to wherever they're going. And they have a little label, and that label holder has a paper label in it telling where that sack is supposed to go, and they're on these big conveyor belts. Well, people would have to pick those up, and they'd have to key in information as to where that conveyor belt ought to take that sack. And so we came up with a way of scanning that. And then the information went down the line to the conveyor, and it diverted off and dropped into the right truck. And it worked beautifully. So they said, oh, we're going to buy those. Post office is going to buy those. So they put out an RFP solicitation, and they had the specs in there and so on. And so we submitted our bid. And again, I was a very young contract administrator at the time. We submitted our bid, and a week went by, and I called the contracting officer, and I said, you know, when will you be awarding us the contract? And the guy said, oh, we've already awarded it. I said, I haven't seen it in the mail. He said, well, it wasn't awarded to you. I said, what do you mean it wasn't awarded? We developed that product. You know, that's our product. You can't award that to somebody. Oh, we did. He awarded it to Fairchild up the road from you. What was wrong? He said, well, you didn't respond to one of the specification requirements. I said, which one? He said, well, there's a requirement in there that it had to sustain a drop from 15 feet. Okay, let me check. So I went back to the engineers and said, you know, he says we didn't get the award because of this 15-foot drop requirement. And did we not respond to it? Well, no, we didn't because, you know, it's never going to be on a line where you're going to be able to drop it 15 feet. So we didn't respond to that. So I went back to the contracting officer. I said, well, what was about this 15-foot drop? He said, well, we discovered in the pre-production item that when the operators wanted to take a break, they would throw it on the floor, the scanner. And we measured, and that was equivalent to a 15-foot drop. And so you had to address that. You had to be able to survive being thrown on the floor. So that's my way of saying, when you get those technical requirements, there's a saying, you better answer them. They're saying, answer the mail. Answer the mail. Every requirement has to be addressed. Let me tell you, any bid that I was involved with after that, every paragraph in that specification was checked off. Yeah, we answered that here. Yeah, we answered that here. Yeah, we answered that here. So you learn you learn as you go through this process. The sources sought can be used for making a determination for making a set-aside. And then on the combined solicitation and the synopsis, so you can call in and get a copy of the solicitation in those cases. And we talk about indefinite quantity, firm fixed price, multiple awards, time and material. We haven't talked about those yet. The time and material contract, the government is going to buy services. And they're normally going to buy it by labor category. You're going to have a senior engineer, and you're going to sell that senior engineer for $100 an hour. The government's going to come out and buy 100 hours. Well, at the end of having furnished 100 hours, your contractual requirement is ended. You don't have to continue working, even if the job hasn't been finished. Under a time and material contract, your only requirement is to provide the time that has been contracted for. Now, it's going to be at a fixed rate for that particular individual, that particular labor category. That's not to say that there can't be situations where they would come to you and say, hey, I want to buy 100 hours, and gee, that price you have in there is for a price of one, so why don't you give me a fixed price for a whole 100? And you might be willing to do that, and that's fine. But at the conclusion of having done the 100 hours, you're still finished. If they want you to continue working, they have to buy more hours. It's inherent in a time and material contract. Now, there are going to be materials in there, too. Now, the reason that you need to focus in on that is that the materials are at no profit. The materials come through just at cost. So if you have to do travel, if you have to provide materials for the engineer to work with and so on, then those are at cost. You don't get any profit on those. And all of that has to be documented in your cost accounting system. So if you're going to be in a situation where you're going to take a time and material contract, then you have to have an acceptable cost accounting system. And there's a lot of those on the marketplace. They're not hard to find. Cost plus fee. You hear all kinds of horror stories about how those get overrun and you know they go on and on and waste the government money and so on. They're normally used in situations where you can't estimate up front what something's going to cost. I mean, if you're going to build a space shuttle, you know, there's no way you're going to be able to estimate how much that's going to cost. And that space shuttle was built on a cost-plus contract. Now, the fee, you know, you would hear a lot of people say that the fee is a percentage of the cost. It isn't really. The fee is fixed for that project. And so if you had a project the estimate was going to cost $100, and you negotiated a fee of $10 to do that job. If the cost for that job became $200, the fee would still be $10. The fee doesn't go up as the cost goes up. It's a fixed fee. Now, and there are other types of cost-plus contracts. There's cost-plus incentive fees, and there's the cost-plus award fees and so on, all of which have to have a cost incentive. So you hear a lot of words about performance contracting today. Well, that's another word for incentive contracting. You know, we got a new group of people that came in and said, let's really zero in on performance, so we'll call it performance contracting. But it's really incentive contracting. The terminology changes with about every 10 years, and when somebody thinks of a better way to do something, Okay, the Air Force wants the contract to provide all base operation services. That's a pretty broad spectrum of services, isn't it? You might, if you were bidding that, you might be interested in a time and material contract, because you have no idea, no way to estimate what it is you're going to have to do to provide all of those base operation services. So also, then you come down to the second one. How does the Air Force that wants to do that, how do they come up with who's going to do it? They might use one of the RFI routes, right, to see who's out there in the marketplace. Who could we expect to bid on something like this? Who should we be soliciting? Are there small businesses that could do this? And if there are, and they have the capability that we're looking for, then, you know, we could make this a set-aside. Looking for raincoats. Cut and dried item, right? You don't need to have any sophisticated RFP process or RFI or any of that sort of thing. You can go out with an IFB and buy those. In fact, you might even go to a GSA schedule that will have raincoats. That you just buy off that schedule. Language translation. That's going to be on a got to be on a time and materials basis too. I mean, you don't want to pay somebody to sit around and wait while you come up with something for them to translate. You want them to come on board when you have something to translate. So you do a time and material contract for that. And the State Department would want those prices locked in, so they'd want an IDIQ contract with the prices already established. You know, if we understand what the government buys, then we can zero in on what we sell or what we would like to sell. How we can tweak what it is that we sell to correspond with what the government is buying. And you're going to see all kinds of different solicitations. And we're going to show you that how to go through those solicitations and determine. I mean, the solicitations can be 1,000 pages. Can be 1,500 pages. It can be 150 pages. It can be tremendous documents. We're going to show you how to go down through those documents and pick out the parts that you have to be very, very conversant with and have to respond to. Because obviously a lot of it's boilerplate. You know, you look at government contracting. You know, we have a regulation that's yay thick. Those were all written because somebody took advantage. Somebody took advantage of the government. And so the regulation was written to stop that from happening with the next contract that was awarded. And so those regulations then find their way into clauses, contract clauses. And 90% of those are not of any concern to most straightforward businesses, because you're not going to do the things that are prohibited by those clauses anyway. But somebody did at one point. Somebody took advantage, and so they wrote a clause to prevent it.
Well, that is a series of the first section that we're doing. It's called Defining the Scope, is understanding the terminology that the government uses, local, state, and federal government uses, and looking at a contract. That gives you a basis to start from. So tomorrow we're going to go and expand from that and go into another topic of it. And we're going to go explore this a little bit more further, what you need to do in order to get a contract. So, again, you can download this episode on iTunes on Blog Talk Radio. You can get that information from there. If you want to reach out to us, just go ahead and shoot us an email, and we can reach out to you at info@thecorebusinessshow.com. And tomorrow we're going to be taking a look at the next part of this is laying your groundwork, what you need to do to set your business up in order to get awarded a contract. You're listening to The Core Business Show. I'm Tim J.K., your host. It's been a pleasure of serving you today. We're going to close out with our show and look forward to talking to you later. Everybody, thank you for listening. Take care.
Thank you for listening to The Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet. For more information about equipment financing and asset-based loans, visit our website, applecapitalgroup.com. That's applecapitalgroup.com. Or call us at 866-611-7457. We hope you'll join us for our next episode. And remember, you can always get to The Core via iTunes. You'll find all our previous episodes there. And thanks again for listening to The Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet.